My name is Chris Schluter. I'm president of the Hawaii County Bar Association. Before we begin today's court proceeding, I'd like to briefly acknowledge our guests and partners. On behalf of the Hawaii County Bar Association and our Big Island community, we welcome and express our sincere appreciation to the Hawaii Supreme Court for scheduling this unique event. We acknowledge the strong and important commitment of the justices, court staff, Judiciary History Center, and security team. We would like to thank the Hawaii State Bar Association, in particular President Craig Wagnold and Vice President Calvin Young, for their dedication to this program and helping to organize this event. We welcome and thank participating high schools, including all students and teachers from Waiakea High School, Keao High School, St. Joseph High School, Hilo High School, Lapu'ahoe High School, Hawaii Academy of Arts and Sciences, and Connections New Century Public Charter School. A special thanks is given to Waiakea Student Government students under Donna Tanabe as well. Next, we thank our Hawaii County Bar Association attorneys for their volunteer service, along with the Chief Court Administrator for the Circuit Court, Lester Oshiro, for his organizational efforts. A special thanks is owed to the attorneys and the litigants participating in this case, attorneys Joyce Ann Buenaventura and Andrew Iwashita, along with Ms. Collins and Mr. Wassel, for agreeing to participate in today's oral argument. Lastly, we thank the University of Hawaii at Hilo's Performing Arts Center and Political Science Division for their planning work and serving as a host school. Just a few reminders, the following court session will be a formal proceeding. Please turn off all cell phones, do not talk during the oral argument, and please no photography. Please stand when the justices enter the courtroom. The argument will last approximately 1 hour. Following the argument, the students will continue with their educational program, so we kindly ask members of the public to leave at that point. Thank you for your anticipated cooperation, and at this point, the court will be called to order. Thank you very much.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SPWC-30070, Collins v. Wassel. Arguing for the petitioner, Joy San Buenaventura. Arguing for the respondent, Andrew Kubitschka.
Good morning and aloha, everyone. The court is honored to be here today at the UH Hilo Performing Arts Center as part of our Courts in the Community program. Counsel, are you ready to proceed this morning?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Mr. Iwashita, are you ready as well? Okay, it's my understanding, Ms. San Buenaventura, that you reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so the green light will come on with 10 minutes to go. Mr. Iwashita, we will give you a 3-minute warning when you are nearing the end of your argument. Very well, please proceed, Ms. San Buenaventura.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this court has held in Gusson versus Gusson that any fixed rule regarding property division is repugnant to the Hawaii Revised Statutes 580-47's just and equitable division, and that general partnership principles govern property division for divorcing couples. That general partnership principle model, as stated in Gusson, is that each partner is entitled to be repaid his or her contributions to the partnership property, whether made by way of capital or advances, and share equally in the profits and surplus remaining after all liabilities are satisfied. Nowhere in the partnership model does a partner who contributes more than 50% get punished with none of her premarital contributions completely invalidated, which is what occurred here. As Justice Rayforth of the Intermediate Court of Appeals has stated in his dissent, while the weight to be assigned to the contributions is for the family court to decide, it is error to ignore them entirely. Thus, the Intermediate Court of Appeals, in creating this fixed rule of Hellbush, which created the incongruous result that occurred here, because it required the family court to determine first whether or not this economic partnership occurred before it would consider any deviation from the uniform starting points. By creating this fixed rule, the Intermediate Court of Appeals violated Gusson versus Gusson and violated the model partnership, the general partnership model as required in HRS 580-47.
Well, Ms. Sanbuena Ventura, you know, Mr. Iwashita argued in his response to the application that it's the intent of the parties that should be the key to whether there's a partnership formed, and the parties here expressly agreed not to enter into a partnership. What's your response to that argument? Before, back in 2000, they agreed not to enter into a partnership. It was not until 2005, in his view, that they did finally decide to enter into an economic partnership. But in 2000, their express intent was not to form a partnership.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. They agreed not to be legally married. They did not, there was no agreement not to form an economic partnership. In fact, the very intent not to form this economic, not to be legally married, is a joint economic decision where both parties benefited. Even the trial court has stated that their intent for the wife's children to be able to file financial aid applications as if she were single benefited both parties.
Did Mr. Wassel pay any part of the children's education?
No, and he never intended to.
And that was, you folks haven't challenged that. So whatever economic partnership that existed, it did not include what was potentially the biggest expense, right? I mean, we're talking $52,000 a year or something like that. That was potentially what the children's school payment, right?
That's true. However.
Okay, what about with the mortgages on both of the units that they own? Who paid for the mortgages?
It ended up that my client ended up paying the mortgages.
Your client paid for her mortgage. At the very end, she paid. But what about all the rents that were coming in? Wasn't Mr. Wassel keeping?
Yes, okay. He kept that. However,
separate bank accounts except for the one joint bank account?
Yes.
So whatever partnership that you're arguing, it certainly didn't include everything. Would you agree? So we're talking about a joint enterprise that it seems to me, at best, was partial.
It was partial in a certain extent, but in reality, it was mostly a partnership for both parties that they economically.
So is the judge supposed to apply a partial ratio? Because it looks like the primary expenses, even the living expenses, it appears that $1,500 of the $2,000 that was monthly expenses were not being split. Is that correct? That's what the family court found. Specifically, it was about $1,900 of monthly expenses, with $500 going into the monthly account.
Okay, Your Honor, we disagreed with that, and because what the family court did, as pointed out in our opening brief, was it used the current income and expenses, where at that time my client was then paying rent, whereas before, during the premarital cohabitation period, she paid the mortgage of the townhouse, he pocketed the rent, and at the time when the townhouse was sold, there was no rent. So the reality was, and this is pointed out in my opening brief, when you look at the income and expense statements at the time of the premarital cohabitation, where especially after the mortgage was completely paid out, their monthly expenses was very minimal. The majority of the expenses was going for shelter, okay, which she paid off.
Counsel, excuse me. The definition of a premarital economic partnership that was set out in Hellbush seems so general and broad that it would make every relationship potentially one subject to the family code. Because the definition says that the man and a woman cohabit and apply their financial resources as well as their energies and efforts to and for the benefit of each other's persons, assets, and liabilities. Isn't that so broad that it potentially makes every relationship subject to the family law?
That's true. And it also creates the arbitrariness of that has occurred here.
And in fact, that definition that was just read and was adopted, it doesn't even have the intention of the parties. It looks like to me that you can just look at the receipts and determine the intent of the parties has no relationship to applying that test.
That's correct. And that's the reason why one of my arguments is that the family court had abused its discretion by focusing on the intent of the parties to not be legally married.
So in a premarital agreement, or a prenuptial agreement, which is clearly the intent of the parties, that's applied before marriage, we look at the intent of the parties. But in a cohabitation situation, if there was a pre-cohabitation agreement, it wouldn't apply because we don't look at the intent of the parties?
We do look at the intent of the parties to enter into the economic partnership, and in this case, they did enter into such. The intent need not be written. It need not be expressed. It could be implied. And in this particular case, it was implied. They acted as if they were man and wife, except for the fact that they chose not to be legally married. They commingled, as even the trial court has found. He used his efforts in fixing up this townhouse so that it could be sold. She used her efforts in putting in money that paid for his utilities and that allowed him to substantially increase his assets.
Ms. San Buenaventura, what's the significance that they kept independent financial identities?
I don't believe there should be any significance to that, Your Honor. And that has been stated in Epp versus Epp. And that has been really in family law for a number of years. The fact that they kept separate accounts is not considered to be something to vary from the model partnership, the partnership model, the general partnership model.
But you were just indicating that the intent matters. Why wouldn't separate bank accounts? That seems to be manifesting an intent.
Your Honor, what I meant was that the trial court should be vested with determining and weighing, as Justice Rayforth had said, the amount of contributions to the partnership.
Do you agree that our standard of review is abuse of discretion?
I believe the Hawaii Supreme Court standard of review is grave error, that the ICA gravely erred
In terms of appellate review of what the trial court does, do we review the family court's decisions for abuse of discretion?
As far as property division, Your Honor, that is the current case law. However, the abuse of discretion.
So if we apply abuse of discretion, even if we would not have decided the same way, we would still defer if there is a rational basis for the court's decision to the court's determination.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. As it's stated in Gusson versus Gusson, abuse of discretion does not mean that the trial court can do what it pleases. It has to do so within the confines of the law.
And are you saying that the family court was clearly erroneous in terms of some of its findings?
Yes.
Which ones?
Not necessarily. Excuse me, Your Honor. Not necessarily its findings, Your Honor, but its conclusion and how it applied general partnership principles. I don't believe the family court even used general partnership principles. What the family court did was it erroneously interpreted Hellbush to require this commingling, comprehensive commingling of finances, assets, and energies akin to that found in a business partnership. That is not what Hellbush required. That is where the error occurred, Your Honor, was that by requiring this comprehensive commingling of finances, assets, and energies, the trial court completely invalidated the premarital partnership.
Hellbush itself didn't go on premarital economic partnership. I mean, it wasn't decided on that basis, was it?
Hellbush itself implied that, Hellbush came after this court's decision in Gusson versus Gusson, which basically stated that uniform starting positions, USPs, were violative of 580-47. However, it could be used as a guideline, as rebuttable presumptions.
I guess what I was asking was, Hellbush did not decide the case on the holding on the basis of a premarital economic partnership.
I believe in Hellbush used that as one of the, Hellbush stands for that proposition, Your Honor, was that my understanding of Hellbush, that was a farm, a couple who put in joint energies in creating this farm premaritally. And then the question occurred was whether or not, even though one spouse put in all his money and the land in creating this farm, where the other spouse also put in energies towards this farm, whether or not the premarital partnership, whether or not the uniform starting point should be before
it,
that.
I'm just wondering if Hellbush measured the division of property from the date of marriage rather than the date of cohabitation.
My understanding, Your Honor, if the Hellbush required that if there is a premarital partnership, economic partnership, then it is measured from the date of cohabitation or whenever the premarital economic partnership occurred. Our position is, Your Honor, that in a correct application of Hellbush, where the trial court did not require this comprehensive commingling of finances, where the trial court did not focus on the intent of the parties to have separate legal identities so that they can fill out truthfully a financial aid form that would benefit my client's children.
Excuse me, the court made a specific finding that each of the parties would maintain a separate financial identity, in part so that Ms. Collins could qualify for financial aid. Why isn't that a specific finding that is determinative of the ultimate issue here?
Because there is a line of cases before that, specifically Epp versus Epp, and how family court decisions after that, that the mere decision to have separate accounts is insufficient.
I'm saying financial identity. I'm not saying separate accounts. It sounds like to me what you're arguing is that the intent of the parties and the actions of the parties doesn't matter. As long as they're sharing day-to-day expenses, that's enough.
The fact that the parties found that there is separate financial identities, I agree, Your Honor. I believe that it's irrelevant, especially when it comes to property division. Because of the line of cases that started with Epp versus Epp, which has not been overruled by this court. In Epp versus Epp, separate accounts which imply the party's intent to have separate identities was considered to be irrelevant as far as property division.
I may have.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, but it just strikes me that in prenuptial agreements where the party's intent to maintain their own independent financial identity is determinative, but in this cohabitation situation, you're arguing that a completely different rule.
That's not true, Your Honor. I don't believe that that's what I'm arguing, Your Honor. If there is a premarital agreement that complies with the Uniform Premarital Agreement Act, then of course, by legislation, that Uniform Premarital Agreement, that premarital agreement is of course enforceable.
So we could have a different result as to the cohabitation period versus the marriage period, despite identical intent of the parties.
That is what has occurred here, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is that is against what this court in Gusson has stated, which is general partnership principles should govern, especially where we have this general statute in 580-47, vesting the trial court with discretion to fairly and equitably divide the properties. And so when you are required to use general partnership principles with rebuttable presumptions of the uniform starting points, then the trial court is vested with determining the amount, the weight to be determined for the contributions, and
you didn't make any claim for Mr. Wassel's retirement benefits, did you? Well, assuming you didn't, and you didn't make any claim for title to his automobile, did you?
That was part of the property division chart, Your Honor.
Right. So there are several things you didn't make claim to with respect to dividing up the property.
There was a time of separation. There was an agreement between the parties. And so by stipulation, so there are certain things, like the vehicles, for instance, were divided, okay? And it was by stipulation. However,
they each had individual accounts in addition to the joint account?
Yes, Your Honor. And that was divided by the trial court.
So if on one hand there are all these titles that are to property that's held individually, and on the other hand there was some sharing with respect to the living quarters, because I suppose if they were cohabiting, then they would want to live essentially in the same quarters. Doesn't that present a kind of a close question on whether or not there was a premarital economic partnership or not?
Again, Your Honor, yes, it does.
So
because then there's
a
question of, like, for instance, like Chen versus Hofflinger, as Justice Rayforth has pointed out, is a particular case where it appears that mere cohabitation was sufficient to be an economic partnership.
So if there's a close question, shouldn't we leave that up to the trial judge who dealt directly with the parties and was able to assess their demeanor and had the responsibility of deciding the case in the first place? If it's a close question, shouldn't we defer to the trial court's decision?
If it is a close question, so long as the trial court uses its discretion within the confines of the law, because that's basically what an abuse of discretion standard is that so long as the trial court did not focus in on irrelevant factors and used the law required in this case, which is the general partnership model, then yes, Your Honor. The general partnership model requires the family court to determine what the partnership's contributions are and whether and what weight it should be given in order to determine property division.
Counsel, what was the difference in how the couple managed their finances, premarital as opposed to postmarital?
There was no difference, Your Honor, except postmaritally, the children, the adult children have graduated from college, And so there was no need to pay for college expenses, Your Honor.
But insofar as maintaining their separate accounts, after they got married, they still continued to maintain those separate accounts?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Was there evidence in the trial court that Mr. Getting confused with the names here, sorry, Wassel. Mr. Wassel used the money that he had to pay for all of the meals that they ate out?
No, Your Honor, I believe the evidence was that he used he paid for some of the meals when they ate out.
It wasn't like 90%?
Close to that, yes, Your Honor.
And Justice Pollack asked about the intent issue. Helbush does not seem to have an intent requirement. Are you advocating for an intent requirement? In other words, that the trial court should be looking at what the intent of the parties were as to whether or not to form an economic partnership, premarital economic partnership?
Your Honor, when we go into the intent, is the problem that then the trial court will then may use irrelevant factors such as what happened in this case.
Well, did the trial court make any finding as to the actual intent of the parties?
I believe the trial court did.
Okay, where did it say the intent of the parties was not to form a premarital economic partnership?
No, I don't believe there's an actual finding of that. However, the family court did talk about the motives of the parties.
Well, and the family court found that in order to avoid the consequence related to the college, Mrs. Collins and Mr. Wassel agreed they would not mail their marriage license and certificate to the Department of Health, and that each of them would maintain separate financial identities. Now, is that the same as finding, in your view, the same as a finding that they intended to not form a partnership?
I don't believe that's the same kind of intent, Your Honor, because clearly the party's actions in contributing to this joint account, which paid for most of their expenses, as well as their cohabitation, as well as their joint energies in supporting each other's assets, clearly show their actual intent to form this partnership.
I thought the family court found that joint account, $500 a month, only covered about a fourth. I thought the family court found that there was about $1,900 that was the monthly expenses, and that wasn't including rent.
That's correct. That's what the trial court found. However, Your Honor, in this particular case, the trial court was wrong, because it was not only $500 that went in. All of her tax refunds went in. The monies from the sale of her townhouse also went into this joint account.
And when that selling of the townhouse went in there, this was about, $24,000? It stayed there a little while, and then she took $13,000 out, bought a new car, and put the car in her name.
That's what the trial court found. That's not what occurred, because the trial court used the asset and debt statements filed at the time of divorce. And what occurred was that it was a joint asset, like what I had informed in answer to Justice Acoba's question. The Toyota was a joint vehicle that at time of separation they had agreed that it would be awarded to her. And so at the time of separation, it became hers. And that's why the asset and debt statement at time of divorce showed that the title was in her name. The issue was not whether or not the Toyota Echo was a joint property. It was because the parties had previously stipulated that it was before they even filed for divorce. So what I'm trying to say, Justice, is that when we looked at the actual income and expense statements at the time, because they were required at time of discovery to say what their income and expense statements were at the time of the cohabitation, if you look at those actual expenses, the monies in the joint account was sufficient. And when it wasn't, Ms. Collins put in more money. She not only put in $500, she put in $700. When it wasn't enough, she put in more money. Her tax refunds went in. So if you look at the actual income expense statements, regardless of what the trial court found, There was sufficient money, and that's why there wasn't any debt.
What were the parties' respective monthly incomes, and from where were those incomes derived?
Ms. Collins' income was derived from her salary. Mr. Wassel's income at the time of cohabitation was derived from his salary and the rentals. Okay.
Okay. And in terms of when she paid off his mortgage, and I think the trial court found that she was entitled, that was a loan from which she was entitled to get back. Was there any evidence that they considered that a loan?
No. That was one of our points of error, Your Honor. Neither party testified that it was a loan. It went into the joint account. It was being used for joint purposes. And that's why our position has always been that this was an economic partnership.
Ms. San Buenaventura, you're into your rebuttal time. Would you?
I understand, Your Honor. Thank you.
I know you're answering our questions, so we drew you into your time, but at this point, if there are no further questions from my colleagues, we'll hear from Mr. Iwashita and then hear you in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
I'd like to thank the court for coming to Hilo, for choosing the university's Performing Arts Center, and also like to thank the teachers who put in extra time to educate their students so they could get the most of this real world experience, and also to my fellow lawyers who went and helped in that regard. I'd like to begin by saying that in preparing for this argument today, because I knew there would be high school students here, part of my focus was on what I could do and say, perhaps, so that they could walk away with a couple of concepts after the argument's concluded. And the two that I came up with are fair is fair and a deal is a deal. On the fairness part, Your Honor, I would address the court to HRS 580-47, which is the foundational statutory authority for the court to grant a divorce and requires the family court to make an equitable or fair division of the property. And upon review, because the court has acknowledged that the standard of review is abuse of discretion, in reviewing the record, I believe that it would be proper for the court to give credence to 580-47.
Do you think intent is an issue?
Yes. And the reason I say that, there was a mention of Epp and Gussin in the opening argument. Both of those cases, in addressing the partnership model, specifically state that before beginning the net market value analysis, the first consideration for the court, as I've noted in my briefs, is whether or not there is an agreement between the parties that resolve some of the partnership
property division. How do you respond to opposing counsel's statement that, you know, the fact that they actually had a marriage ceremony in 2000, and then they agreed not to send in the marriage license so that she could obtain the benefits of being a single parent to educate her children, her college children. That in and of itself was a joint economic decision.
It was an agreement. I'm not sure I agree with the characterization that it's a joint economic decision.
Didn't your client actually benefit from that decision, because that meant that his partner would have more assets to bring into their household?
That argument was never made. There's no record. I think that I understand the court's direction on that. As far as the agreement is concerned, Your Honor, as the court's aware in my briefing of this case, the laws in Hawaii statute and the case law, and Gussin, Tugas, and all those cases that we're familiar with that establish the partnership model, again, as I was beginning to say earlier, make it clear that at the very beginning of an analysis in property division, the court must address whether or not there are any agreements between the parties. I think it's relevant and pertinent in an appellate review because if, and obviously I totally disagree with Justice Reifert's dissent in the Intermediate Court of Appeals decision, but even if you assume for the moment that Justice Reifert has a point, that the next step in the analysis, which Justice Reifert did not do, was to do a what he called a practical consequence analysis in the Chen case, what I would call a harmless error analysis. And what that would involve in this case, the record is clear, undisputed, as far as the fact of this agreement, that it occurred immediately after the ceremony in 2000, that there was an express purpose. All the elements of a valid contract are present. An offer, a proposal by Mrs. Collins at the time, an acceptance by my client as to all of the elements that they were going to perform, and they did perform over the next 5 years for the specific purpose of allowing Mrs. Collins's two daughters to get $175,000 $78,000 worth of college education for her paying $28,000. So there was all of that's undisputed in the record. And so the point is that Judge Bartholomew, in hearing this case, when you apply the partnership model and you start off with date of marriage, net market valuations, which he did, and he came down with the property division based upon that, the marriage being in January of 2005. Excuse me. The next part is addressing the Hellbush issue raised by the appellant in this case. And in doing so, it's important to look at the intent of the parties, as the court has raised earlier. And clearly, when you take that intent into account, and I would argue it's a binding valid contract that they entered into and fully performed, and only after it was fully performed, when Ms. Collins,
if intent is an issue, where is the finding that says the parties did not intend to form or did intend or did not intend to form an economic partnership? I see a lot of findings with respect to the parties agreed that it made a lot more sense for her to remain single for college tuition purposes. But I'm not sure I saw any finding with respect to what the actual intent of the parties was.
Judge Bartholomew's finding was basically substantiated by the evidence in which that both parties intended to keep this separate economic financial identity. That's what he
found. For purposes of getting the financial aid.
Right. And he also pointed out, and I think, you know, the point has been raised earlier that Hellbush is a very general statement. And I think that Judge Burns, in writing that decision, basically was very upfront at the very beginning, saying, I have to review all of the laws as far as property division, and he did that. But the actual holding in Hellbush made no reference at all, and was not, and as Justice Acoba inquired earlier, the Hellbush decision made no finding at all based upon its premarital economic partnership.
Mr. Uchita, didn't the ICA and the trial court go beyond Hellbush, even if putting Hellbush aside, whether it's a good test or not, and you didn't challenge that test? Didn't the ICA and the trial judge say, well, there has to be a comprehensive intermingling of the assets or of the parties or their financial resources, and that this has to be akin to a business? Didn't they go that far to say that it had to be akin to a business?
The Intermediate Court of Appeals did include 2.5 pages of Judge Bartholomew's 21-page findings of fact, conclusions of the law, and decision in its majority decision. And the part that it did include the language that Judge Bartholomew's analysis of Helbush, based upon what was there. The law is clear. If the proof was just cohabitation, you don't get a Helbush premarital economic partnership. If all you have is cohabitation.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure if you answered my question.
I would like to, I'm almost there, Judge.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Sorry.
So, so starting with that basis, right? And I think that it is troubling. There are some cases that basically you have cohabitation and sharing of expenses and so forth, which in my mind it becomes a troubling aspect of applying Helbush. You know, Helbush, the facts of Helbush, you know, include the farming and so forth, and both of the husband and the wife in that case worked the farm together. In this case, you have Mr. Wassel, who was instructor here at the university at the time, and you have Mrs. Collins, who is a Department of Education teacher, and they, you know, went to work during the day, came back, and basically lived a life in that manner. There's no economic enterprise that they engaged in together, like in Helbush.
Well, isn't Ms. San Buenaventura's point that during this 4-year period or 5-year period from 2000 to 2005, there was a substantially greater increase in Mr. Wassel's net worth than in Ms. Collins's, something on the order of 200% for him and hers was less than 50%, and that it was Ms. Collins's contributions to the partnership by subsidizing, by allowing him to live rent-free, by paying a mortgage at one point, that allowed that accumulation of wealth to occur, and that I guess the argument would be that itself is evidence of an intent to serve as a partnership, unless the suggestion is those were just gifts by her. Were they just gifts?
Your Honor, I would address and respond to that by noting that when in 2000, when they went through their first ceremony to get married, and then the agreement followed to keep everything separate, that is really a defense. You know, those are facts. I don't think that would be repeated again in any case that in Hawaii or ever. Those are very unusual facts. And when I got this case, you know, that really stood out to me, that you have an agreement. And so, in most cases you don't. People fall in love, they start living together, and then you get married, and then you go down this Helbush road. Well, in this case, you have this agreement. And the argument is, the agreement is not binding in some way. It's just as Judge Reifert says, it's irrelevant. That is, frankly, Your Honor, is incomprehensible to me, that an agreement that when you're talking about what an economic partnership, and all of the cases, Gussin, Tugas, all of the cases talk about applying, it's a business model. When we're talking about property division in a family court divorce setting, all of the lawyers know that what you're talking about is applying straight business dissolution principles to this situation.
The objective of a business is totally different from that of, I would think, cohabitation, right? We're not looking for profit, although apparently after a divorce, there's more money to be made on one side or the other. But coming back to what I asked you originally, so did the trial court and the ICA go off Helbush by saying that this has to be akin to a business model or akin to a business?
Let me answer that in two parts, Your Honor. First, yes, Judge Bartholomew clearly says that because Helbush requires more than just cohabitation, it just can't be cohabitation and sharing expenses and so forth. It has to be something more than that to have a premarital economic partnership.
Let me ask you this then. Even if we look at intent under the law, intent takes into consideration all the circumstances. So if you look at all the circumstances, isn't the fact that Ms. Collins helped to pay off the mortgage, She contributed, what, $700 to the joint account, et cetera. Obviously, they live together. Doesn't that point to the fact that she was doing this for the benefit of Mr. Wassel, and in doing so, she enhanced the value of his assets? In other words, the home he owned in Hawaii Paradise Park.
The value of Mr. Wassel's home did grow. It was not because of any really improvements or anything like that. It's basically a market situation from 2000 to 2005.
But she helped pay the mortgage on that.
During that period, she made that one payment at the end to pay off the $5,000+ to, or so, plus or minus dollars to pay off the final principal amount of the mortgage. That is correct.
And he lived rent-free in her townhouse for a period of time while he was renting out the other property, but not sharing the rents with her, correct?
That's correct.
Well, wasn't there evidence that he was paying for about 90% of their meals out?
Yes.
There's no finding with respect to that, right?
There is, well, all of these questions.
Well, let me ask you, didn't the sale of her home in Pacific Heights go into the joint account?
Yes, it did, Your Honor.
And which benefited Mr. Wassel, because that was used to defray the expenses of food and gas and utilities, right?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no question that, you know, as Judge Bartholomew pointed out, when people live together and they share expenses, there's going to be, I mean, that's a normal part of it.
There's clearly some aspects of this where they're sharing expenses, but it would seem like if we're comparing this to a marriage, because this is what we're doing, we're kind of pushing the time frame, the date of marriage, sort of where I think the understanding is in a marriage, the partners, the spouses come together and form an economic unit. And what here, it seems as if what we don't have, unit means one, and what we have here is a situation where certain aspects seem to be joint, but there's other aspects like how they kept their houses and who kept the rents and paying for the children and all these other aspects that were separate. So we have a little bit of both here. Would you agree?
Yes, Your Honor. It was... I think that really, as much as there's a great effort by the appellant to take away the intent of the parties and what was really going on at that time, the reality is that they made an agreement to be separate financial entities, and they acted pretty much in that regard and to fulfill that, and so that Ms. Collins' daughter could go to Claremont McKenna and Lewis and Clark. And if they got married, they would not be able to do that because she would not be able to afford the tuition based upon the marriage and the increase in her share.
Mr. Iwashita,
so, yes.
At the beginning of your argument, you stated one of the things that you wanted to get across to the students was fair is fair.
Yes, Your Honor.
If Ms. Collins contributed premaritally to enhance Mr. Wassel's net worth, why isn't it fair that she gets to share in that?
Because the deal was that Ms.
Well, we're talking about the fairness now.
Yes.
See, there are two issues.
Yes.
Fair is fair and a deal is a deal.
Right.
I'm asking you about the fair is fair part.
And I'm going to address my answer based upon the fairness of the deal. The fairness of the deal is inherent in Mrs. Collins getting $178,000 worth of college tuition for $28,000. Mr. Wassel gets none of that. It's not his daughter's. When he gets old, they're not going to take care of him. They'll take care of her.
Mr. Wassel did not benefit from the fact that she had a lot more money to bring into the household by not having to pay all that tuition?
I'm not saying that there wasn't that benefit, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that they made a deal, a conscious deal, And that deal is not an inequitable deal. It's a fair deal. And so that when Judge Bartholomew, in exercising his discretion...
What was the deal?
The deal was that they would be separate financial entities...
For purposes of her getting financial aid.
Right. And specifically, and this is an uncontroverted, unchallenged finding by Judge Bartholomew. Also, the second part of it is that so that Mr. Wassel's home and his other assets, right, would not be jeopardized or contribute in any way towards her children's education. And by
that they would get married, but they would suspend the formalities of a marriage in order to allow Ms. Collins to get the benefit, or at least she and her daughters, the benefit of better college tuition. Right? They had a marriage ceremony. Then they decided, because her children were still going to school, they would not send in the marriage license. Then after her daughters graduated in 2005, they got married in 2005. So wasn't that the deal? It was a temporary suspension of their, I don't know if you'd call it intent,
yes,
to
Your Honor.
Be so, married, but and to suspend it for that period of time.
And to take the financial ramifications of that decision. And so that when they got married in 2005, it was clear at that point that it was solely because Ms. Collins' youngest daughter was going to finish up her final semester at Lewis
and Clark. I'm a little bit confused. In terms of the deal with respect to her getting the financial, the benefits of being single legally, was there any evidence as to whether or not Mr. Wassel would have been liable for her children's college education? I'm very confused by all of this because, I mean, why would he be responsible to pay for her children's college education?
There's nothing in the record about that, Your Honor.
So wasn't the actual only benefit? It wasn't. Was there any evidence that he was worried that his assets would be used to pay for her children's college education?
That's the evidence, and that supported and that supports Judge Bartholomew's finding.
Okay, so there
That's
was concern that he would have to pay for her children's college education.
That's the record, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I would, in terms of the questions of this agreement, Hawaii law is really clear, as cited, in EPP, that when we have a valid, the question before the court would be, I would argue, whether or not Judge Bartholomew's decision, can be sustained not only on his stated reasons, which I find, from our perspective are correct, but even if error is found in parts of his decision, that there are sufficient evidence in the record to support his finding, and that would
mean. Where is the finding that they thought that his assets would have to be used to pay for her children's college education?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Mr. Iwashita, thought it was that his assets would be taken into consideration in their applications for financial aid.
That's part of it.
But you're saying that it was in the record that he would have to sell some of his assets to pay for their education?
No, Your Honor. It's not stated that way. Judge Bartholomew's decision is set forth in the ICA decision.
All I see is Mr. Wassel did not believe he was obligated to assist Ms. Collins with a financial burden arising from her daughter's college education. Everything that I read seems to indicate that what they were worried about was that if she was married, then her income goes up, and therefore she might not qualify for all of this.
If I can address the court on page 5 of the majority decision by the Intermediate Court of Appeals, where it quotes Judge Bartholomew's decision, Judge Bartholomew states, on the other hand, It was done so that Mr. Wassel could refrain from shouldering any share of any share of that not insignificant burden, the college expenses. So so that what Judge Bartholomew clearly found, and it's supported by the substantial evidence, that there are two reasons for doing this agreement, and both are substantiated by the evidence. From the appellate perspective in reviewing Judge Bartholomew's decision, it can look at, I would direct the court's attention to the Epp decision and the holding there in at page 79 of 80 Hawaii, where basically it states one or more valid and enforceable premarital, marital agreements or divorce agreements may modify the partnership if the agreement in total or in part excludes some or all of the net market value of the assets and the debts of the parties. So in this case, what we have is an agreement by the parties in June of 2000, basically to, I would argue, exclude Mr. Wassel's residence from any consideration in a divorce. And then when the terms of the agreement expired in January of 2005, they got married. And
but now, so you raised that argument in the Intermediate Court of Appeals. In fact, it was your lead argument, but it doesn't appear that that was the argument upon which the Intermediate Court of Appeals based its decision. So
yes.
Are you suggesting the Intermediate Court of Appeals got it wrong and
no.
We should look in another direction?
No. The intermediate, the majority, judges Nakamura and Foley, got it right. They applied the correct appellate standard, abuse of discretion. They cited Judge Bartholomew, 2.5 pages of Judge Bartholomew's 21-page decision, which is very comprehensive and impressive in my view, that supported his decision on this aspect of the property division. And the intermediate court majority rightfully deferred because there is really no clear error in Judge Bartholomew's decision. And so the ICA clearly deferred in a one paragraph part of its decision to Judge Bartholomew's finding and conclusions and decision and affirmed his decision. I think that is the proper outcome in this case. Justice Reifert, I raise the arguments I am doing now because of Justice Reifert's dissent and his decision that there was error in applying the Hellbush principles as he sees it. But again, as I stated earlier, Justice Reifert did not do the harmless error analysis. And if you do the harmless error analysis on this case and look at the entire record, what Judge Bartholomew found is eminently fair. Essentially, the parties got married in 2005, and at the divorce decree entered in 2009, he basically said, Mr. Wassel, you get to keep your house mortgage free, you're retired, you can live there basically the rest of your retirement. What he awarded to Mrs. Collins was her retirement assets, which were valued at that time about $240,000. I'm sorry, the retirement assets were about $100,000. The total assets she received was $140,000. And essentially they got what they started with in 2005.
No, but didn't he capture a greater extent of the appreciation of those assets? And that's exactly Ms. Collins' argument, isn't it? That she was contributing to what she understood was a joint venture and a partnership. As a result of that, his assets substantially increased in value, yet she's not sharing in the benefit of that increase in value. How is that fair? You said fair is fair. How is that fair?
Fair is fair because when you look at that argument, you have to look at her agreement. She essentially is saying, yes, I made this deal so that my daughters could go to college and I could get the benefit of paying $28,000 for $178,000 worth of tuition, but I don't want to be bound by that deal. I want to be able to now get $85,789, which is the stated amount that she is seeking in her proposed property division and allocation, which reflects basically the inflationary market increase in the value of Mr. Wassel's property. Substantially, that's where it is.
Are we partly here just because her townhouse, her unit went down in value and his went up?
Well, her townhouse was not there. She had already sold it. So we're here, yes, because of the fortuity and the exigency of the real estate market in Paradise Park between 2000 and 2009. The difference between that and the increase in value from 2005 and 2009 is this $170,000 plus increase in the market value of a house. It's not because they built an extension or, you know, added onto the house or put a second house on
the
property.
So the major difference between your position and Ms. Collins' position is that it's based on this appreciation in real estate value.
That's all it is. That's what the record is.
That's really the basic difference.
Yes, and so, you know, that's
Even if that's the basic difference, shouldn't we look back to when the parties first got married in 2000 and consider that, you know, they got married, they got the license, they went on their honeymoon. It was only because, I guess, they realized that Mr. Wassel's income might be considered in determining the eligibility of Ms. Collins' daughters for tuition break, that they decided to suspend their marriage and then got married when her daughters graduated. If we take all that into consideration, wouldn't a reasonable person come to the conclusion that there was, between 2000 and 2005, at least an economic partnership?
Before I address the court's question, I know it's my
time's expired, but you can certainly answer any of our questions, and then I'll allow you a brief moment to wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. I understand the court's question to be that the agreement was basically to just suspend the marriage, but to really be married and to have all the benefits of an economic partnership. That's my impression of the court's question. And I would say that perspective would be basically totally contrary to the express terms of the agreement, and that because inherently in this agreement, it requires the parties to be separate financial entities, that if they weren't separate financial entities, that Ms. Collins would have been misrepresenting on her college financial aid applications that she was a single mother putting two daughters through school and that she was financially independent and no one was helping her. The reality, and that's the reality they wanted to preserve, and that's the reality that they did. To say now that, well, it was really a marriage, that's not what she put on her college financial aid applications. She put down that she was a single mother with two daughters and no house in the end, right? And had these limited resources so she could get the benefit of those financial aid applications. It's, you know, you want to have your cake and eat it too. It doesn't make sense contractually.
Let me just follow up. Just if in fact the argument that it was a joint enterprise, they were an economic unit, would that make her statements to the schools fraudulent? And would she possibly be subject to have to repay them for stating that she was independently, you know, based on her own finances, and now all of a sudden she's saying in court that actually, no, we had this economic partnership and I had access to all of this, and therefore it's like two different positions.
I agree, Your Honor.
Mr. Iwashita, they had a wedding ceremony.
Yes.
They had friends and family there.
Yes.
They went on a honeymoon.
Yes.
They received gifts, didn't they?
Yes.
They received monetary gifts.
Yes.
When they decided not to, did they send those monetary gifts back to the people?
I don't know, and that's not in the record.
I thought in the record it said that they deposited the monetary gifts into their joint account.
I would have to check. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Off the top of my head, I don't know. But basically, to respond to the in the big picture, pretty much everyone thought they were married, they knew they weren't married, and it was for a very specific reason. And the arguments being made in this throughout this case and up through today is that doesn't matter. that what only matters is that they live together, they shared accounts and shared expenses, and that's what the court should focus on.
Mr. Iwashita, there is a finding of fact. The couple received wedding gifts and gifts of cash at their apparent wedding in June 2000. The cash gifts were deposited into the joint credit union account.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, why would they do that if they didn't think they were really getting married? Why would they do that to their friends? If they didn't
because
think they were forming a partnership that was in everything but name, a marriage, why would they not send the stuff back?
They wanted everybody to think they were married and
did
not
they
living
tell,
in
is
sin.
There any, was there any evidence that they told everybody, in fact, we didn't get married?
No. So the question, though, really, in my mind, if you look at it contractually, was there
any evidence that anyone other than the two of them and whatever they reported to the government officials knew that they had not actually submitted the license?
Department of Health people,
right.
The minister, yeah, it was very limited.
So they didn't tell their families that they actually did not submit the license?
I'm not aware that they did, Your Honor.
There's no evidence of
there,
that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Did they hold themselves out as being married?
That's not in the record, Your Honor, as far as I know. I'm looking at this really as, you know, from an appellate perspective, the review is, I believe the ICA majority is correct. Was there an error? Really, no. And so, you know, did Judge Bartholomew make a decision that falls within the discretion he has under 580-47? The answer is yes, and there's an affirmation. I believe that's as far as the case could go, unless the court is considering redoing Hellbush in some way, but you know, because the record is so clear on the contractual side, and that the models that we use are business dissolution models, clearly that when Judge Bartholomew, you know, states that his belief that in his findings that there needs to be something more akin to a business partnership than just a cohabitation scenario, and he's correct, because cohabitation by itself is not sufficient. So the challenge for the courts now are to define, you know, what that range is, based on the record in this case and the undisputed agreement of the parties, that Judge Bartholomew did not abuse his discretion in using net market values based on the 2005 marriage.
Thank you very much, Mr. Iwashita, for your argument. We'll now hear in rebuttal from Ms. San Buenaventura.
Justices, contrary to what Mr. Iwashita has argued, there was no finding of an actual contract. What he's claiming is an agreement for separate identities solely for the purposes of doing for filling out financial aid forms, which, again, was a joint economic decision for which Mr. Wassel has benefited greatly.
But there was a finding that they agreed, in order to avoid consequences, that they would maintain separate financial identities. I mean, there is a finding. You may not agree with it, but
the agreement was financial identities. That's true, regarding number 17. However, again, under this court's rulings and its progeny of Gussin versus Gussin, partnership model in dividing property division should apply. And the partnership model, partnership contributions should be taken into account, which did not occur here. And that is grave error, as I could. For the ICA to consider that there must be a significant amount of this commingling of assets akin to a business partnership flies in the face of the partnership model that this court espoused in Gussin versus Gussin.
Does the partnership model conflict with our law that says there is no common law marriage? But if you extend the partnership model to relationships which precede a marriage, then aren't we in effect putting common law marriage back into the law as being valid?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And because common law marriage is far more than the partnership model. The partnership model deals with property division as far as partnership contribution. Common law marriage goes
into
custody. But
the same principles, but you're applying the same partnership principles that apply to marriages to situations where there is no marriage, but we treat that situation as if there were a marriage.
For property division purposes, whether or not whatever contributions that the partners go into should be taken into account, yes. As to whether or not mere cohabitation,
Sorry, if your client held herself out and Mr. Wassel out as being, in effect, not married, should she get the benefit of the partnership model? I mean, she made representations to the college. They kept, to some extent, individual accounts. So she got, you know, I don't want to make the argument for the other side, but she, in effect, got the deal she wanted. She got the reduction in tuition by holding herself out as not being married.
The problem with that, Justice, is that it punishes her for a joint decision that benefited both parties. His assets, as even the trial court found, substantially increased because of that joint economic decision. This implied fraud, which they both agreed to, should not punish one without punishing the other.
Despite the fact that there's a joint decision to operate as independent entities, that really shouldn't matter, because for your argument, the partnership model, we just look at whether there was a partnership, and even if that partnership doesn't operate as a single economic unit, we still need to divide the resources as if they were married.
This court should look into the partners' contributions, whether it be by capital, whether it be by money, and determine at that time what weight to give such partner in reimbursing them for its contributions. That is the crux of my argument. The partnership model requires that the parties' contributions should be taken into account and not be completely invalidated, whether it occurred before marriage or after, especially in this case where the other partner substantially benefited, where the partnership substantially benefited.
Didn't your client ask to have her name put on the title of the Paradise Park property?
There is no record to that effect.
I thought there was, and that Mr. Wassel refused to put her name.
I don't believe I saw a finding to that effect, Your
Honor.
Okay,
if I'm incorrect, then I apologize. But I thought I had read that.
That was one other thing I wanted to contradict Mr. Iwashita. This is not just an inflationary increase in value. At the time of cohabitation, the Paradise Park was unfinished. So monies that he was able to save because of this joint decision was used to finish that house. That's the reason why there was this increase in value. Efforts by both parties to finish the Paradise Park house was another joint economic decision towards the business partnership, towards the economic partnership that left Mr. Wassel with almost three times more assets than before the cohabitation occurred, Your Honor.
If you'd like to wrap up, your time's expired, but as I did with Mr. Iwashita, I'll give you a brief moment to wrap up, Ms. N. Buenaventura.
Your Honor, the deal is a deal is correct in the sense that they both had agreed into entering into this economic partnership at the time in 2000. They both used joint efforts. It was an unequal amount of effort. It was an unequal amount of monetary contributions, but that alone, the fact that it was unequal, does not prevent the fact that there was a joint economic partnership for which both parties should be allowed to have a reimbursement of their premarital contributions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. San Buenaventura. The court at this time will take this case under advisement, which means we'll be issuing a decision at a future date. At this point, on behalf of the court, I'd like to acknowledge and thank some of the many people who made this incredible experience here today possible for us, and beginning most significantly, I think, with the students who joined us here today from Connections, New Century Public Charter School, Hawaii Academy of Arts and Science, Hilo High, Laupahoehoe High and Elementary Public Charter School, Waiakea High, Keau High, and St. Joseph School, as well as political science students from the University of Hawaii at Hilo. And I'd like to thank their outstanding teachers as well, Sonia Carvalho, Janine Baker, Ray Kotke, Deborah Sanbei, Curtis Shearer, Lisa Kamalani, Donna Tanabe, Robert Beekman, Nathan Yoakum, and Professor Todd Belt from UH Hilo. You know, the future of our system of government depends on the public's understanding of the Constitution and the protections that it provides, and the commitment and hard work of these students demonstrates that we'll be in good hands going forward. I'd like to ask our audience to all join and acknowledge these students and their teachers. And I'd also like to acknowledge our many special guests and thank our partners in making this event possible today. From the state legislature, we have Senator Gil Kahele, Representative Cliff Tsuji with us. From the County of Hawaii, we have Corporation Counsel Lincoln Ishida, Michael Abesugawa of the Public Defender's Office, Prosecuting Attorney Mitch Roth. From our court here in the Third Circuit on the Big Island, we have Judges Ron Ibarra, Tony Bartholomew, Greg Nakamura, Glenn Hara, and Andrew Wilson here today. We also have many partners who've helped to make today's event possible. They include the wonderful administration and staff here at UH Hilo, here at the theater. Lee Dombrowski and Dory Yamada were absolutely fabulous to work with. I'd also like to thank Donna Tanabe, the student activities coordinator at Waiakea High School, and her Student Government Association students who served so ably as ushers today and assisted us with the logistics of this event. And also from UH Hilo again, Professor Todd Bell, who helped arrange for additional ushers and also made arrangements for us to be able to join with the Hawaii County Bar Association for lunch here on campus after this event. We have many other people who provided support, and I'd like to acknowledge them, the Hawaii State Bar Association, which provided generous support for the students' participation in today's event. We have with us here today Hawaii State Bar Association President Craig Wagnild, along with his wife Debbie, also Hawaii State Bar President-elect, Bar Association President-elect Calvin Young, and I think their presence here today really demonstrates the commitment of the statewide Bar Association to this program. And I'd really like to acknowledge the members of the Hawaii County Bar Association for their tremendous support of this program, in particular Chris Schluter, the president, Newton Chu, who's going to be serving as a moderator later on during the Q&A, and Jerry Hasegawa, who've been absolutely wonderful to work with. And many, many attorneys, too many to name, from the Bar Association worked with the students to help prepare them and explain the case to them. I thank them for all their efforts. We had students from the William S. Richardson School of Law, Casey Bagai, Mari Fujimoto, from the Students for Public Outreach and Civic Education, who prepared the teaching materials to help prepare the students for the argument today, and many, many other individuals who've helped, including Jay Kimura, Kanani Laubach, Cody Friends, Randy Crockett, Martha Rodillas, and Clifford Victorine. I'd like to thank our attorneys, Joyce Ann Benaventura and Andrew Iwashita, for their cooperation, as well as Ms. Collins and Mr. Wassel. And finally, I'd like to thank the Sheriff's Department and the Hawaii County Police Department, as well as our Third Circuit Court Administrator Lester Oshiro and the many judiciary staff who provided support for this event. We deeply, deeply appreciate all of their help. We couldn't have done this without all of them. I hope I've acknowledged everyone by name, but if I haven't, please understand from the bottom of our hearts, we appreciate what you've done in allowing us to bring this oral argument here at Hilo today. So can everyone join me in thanking all the folks who've helped? So once again, on behalf of the court, thank you and aloha. And at this time, the court stands adjourned.
Please rise. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii stands adjourned until further notice. Please be seated.
Thank you, Chief Justice Reckmore and the entire Supreme Court. There will be a brief recess while we rearrange the stage. We kindly ask the members of the public and bar, except the attorney volunteers, please exit the auditorium at this time so that the students can continue their educational program. Students should not leave the auditorium, and we will, otherwise they may be subject to security screening for reentry. Attorneys attending the lunch program should proceed to USCB 127. Please bear in mind that the luncheon is scheduled for 12:15, so there's a little time gap. Once the general public exits the auditorium, we'll resume the program. Thank you very much.